It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
No fear, no fear, no fear here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and our special guest, Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis Bennis is a representative. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and we need to understand what's going on in the Middle East, and she has many books. We've already done an introduction for her, so I want to get to her because we only got about three segments for this, and I want to make sure what's on everybody's mind is Libya. Phyllis, I got you there?
You do. I'm here.
Phyllis, you know, let's go ahead and focus on what's happening in Libya. How is it perceived by your institute and you and your studies in the Middle East? This is our function there is to what? Why are we there?
Well, I think the question of why we're there is a complicated one. I think that what's going on in Libya is very much a part of the set of uprisings for democracy that we're seeing across the Arab world. It took a very different turn in Libya. It was militarized quite quickly with the resistance forces, the opposition forces, taking up arms as well. They include large chunks of the Libyan military. So it has become something that looks a bit more like a civil war. On the other hand, it's not an even divide militarily, and the opposition forces are significantly outgunned and outarmed by the Gaddafi regime. So we have... You know, it's a very bad time for the opposition in Libya. They were facing pretty devastating attacks, and it's not surprising that they asked for help. They wanted a no-fly zone. Some of them even said, we want airstrikes. Some of them said, we don't. Some said, we want to do this ourselves. So there's been different positions. I think more recently, it does seem to be a majority of the Libyan opposition has said, we want a no-fly zone. What they got, which often happens when you're talking about, you know, it's one of these, be careful what you ask for, you might get it and then some. They got then some. They got a lot more than they asked for. They got not only a no-fly zone, but an unlimited use of force authorized by the United Nations with the support of the most powerful European and European countries in the U.S. The U.S., Britain, and France essentially orchestrated this resolution. The U.S. had taken the original resolution that was being put forward by France and Britain that called just for a no-fly zone and said, we're not going to support that because we don't think a no-fly zone alone is going to work. So what we're going to do, instead of saying, well, we don't think a no-fly zone works, so we're going to say no, instead they said, we're going to rewrite the resolution so that it authorizes not only a no-fly zone, but all necessary force, all necessary action. That's what they authorized. So any kind of military action, whether it's with planes or ships or tanks, anything is authorized, even sending in foreign troops. The only thing that's prohibited, well, there's two things. One is it says that there cannot be a foreign military occupation force, but we know that that's a very precise definition that's almost never used. So the 100,000 U.S. troops occupying Afghanistan today, for instance, are not considered an occupation. But you can have troops on the ground. The only restriction is that they can only be used in order to protect civilians. The problem is it's a very fine line to draw when you have the same countries that are sending planes and ships to militarily defend civilians are the same countries that are saying separately, oh, and by the way, we want regime change. We want Gaddafi out. But no, our military is not designed for that. That's other things. So that's a very tricky business. It's not an easy line to draw, if you will. So I think that's a bit of what we're looking at right now. Nobody knows exactly how far we're going to go. This is looking a little bit like Iraq in 1991, when a no-fly zone was declared. Didn't lead to the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, but it did lead to 700 Iraqi civilians being killed over the years by our bombs. And the problem is, of course, once military force gets used, you don't usually have a lot of options about choosing how to respond. So when President Obama said, for instance, there will be no U.S. troops on the ground, I think he means it. I think that is his intention. But the problem is, what happens when you have, as you did this morning, you had a U.S. plane either shot down or crashed after mechanical difficulties of some sort. We don't really know what happened, but we know it crashed. And luckily, it crashed in an area controlled by the opposition, who quickly managed to rescue the pilot and the bomber and somehow managed to get them back to U.S. Custody, which to me says there probably was some kind of a rescue team on the ground. If, on the other hand, that plane had gone down in Gaddafi-controlled territory, I think we definitely would have seen boots on the ground in the form of some kind of a special forces team that would have gone in to rescue them. So once you start participating in a military battle, you don't always get to pick and choose what you're going to be willing to do in the future.
You know, the one thing that did interest me is, well before all of this was done, they were already finding that the British forces had special forces in Libya already. So everything that we're always being told by the administration and the powers that be and the powers that want to project their power, we always find out that what they've been saying is not necessarily what's really the plan. And we're lied to on a regular basis. And I'm wondering, what do you think the end game is? Now, your book, we'll get to Afghanistan, the Middle East in general, but it gives you the perspective that I'm hoping you can share with me and the audience of how is this perceived by the people there? And in addition to that, when we have the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, wants to meet with people, a lot of times there's some opposition saying, no, we don't want to meet with you. We don't have anything to do with you. How is it that you got involved and you get to be the arbiter of? And I please explain to me, from your perspective, the people there, how do they perceive our intentions?
Well, I don't think the Middle East is not a monolithic place. There's lots of different opinions, just like there are here. I don't think we can doubt that there are plenty of people in Libya today who are very glad that the U.S. has led this campaign and that the U.S. and the French and the Brits are bombing Gaddafi's military capacity. Now, if it goes on very long, some of those same people are probably likely to say, you know what, this is not really what we signed up for. But I don't think we can claim, I certainly don't claim, that no one there wants this, that this is all in violation of what the Libyan people themselves want. The Libyan people are very divided, it's clear. It's clear Gaddafi has some support. It's clear the opposition has a lot of support. And it's clear that some of them want this kind of militarization. Not all. But we would be doing ourselves and the truth, I think, a disservice if we denied that there is some support for it. In the rest of the region, I think that people are very wary. There are differences between the Libyan uprising and the others, not least having to do with militarization. All of the other uprisings have been nonviolent, and people have paid a huge price. 300 or so people were killed in Egypt. On Friday, just after the bombing of Libya began, the government in Yemen turned on his own people and massacred a huge, nonviolent, unarmed group of protesters, killing 52 and injuring seriously more than 200. So it was a huge massacre, and that was after they saw the example. Some people were saying, well, we should support this because it gives an example to the other dictators.
Well, you know, when we come back, I want to dwell on that. They're going to push the button on us, but, you know, I want to dwell on the fact that we've had so many things that were examples of why we went to Libya. We haven't gone to the other countries for them doing the same thing, like Bahrain. We'll be right back with Phyllis Bennis in just a minute.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day on LRN.FM Network from Phoenix, Arizona, where it's very nice here on Freedom's Phoenix Farm. Now, we have as our special guest today, it's going to help us understand all things Middle Eastern, Phyllis Bennis from the, she's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she's written extensively on Palestinian-Israeli relations, Afghanistan. Middle Eastern general, of course, has an opinion on what's going on in Libya. And this is exactly what we need. And, of course, she's another root of the grapevine by which we can get some information to her so she can share it with all of the bloggers and all the people that want to have access to information that we know that's translated into Arabic. There are people that are starting to come together on the internet because they can. For the first time in human history, we have peer-to-peer communication that you can type right now, push a button, and it's translated into any language. We have 39 languages that Freedom's Phoenix can be translated into. We have 39 languages the Philosophy of Liberty is in. What happens, and that's one thing, a good question for you, Phyllis, is that the philosophy that we're hoping to espouse by these activists that are wanting change, they want to be able to run their own lives, that if we can instill in them the concept that they own themselves, that, you know, when it started in Cairo is what really prompted us, because we knew that the people of Egypt have been ruled by someone for millennia. You know, the fact that they would be able to, you know, take care of themselves or at least represent themselves is a new concept. And we, doing the demographics, we're finding out that under 15 years of age makes up like 30% of the people in the Middle East. That just shocked me.
It's a very young demographic. I mean, I have a different view than you about the value of government. I think government's a very good thing, and I support government. I don't support repressive governments, but we don't have to talk about that. I think where we agree is that militarizing our involvement in this situation is not going to help anybody, either here in the U.S., where we can't afford it, and in the region where those weapons are likely to turn on the people that they're designed to help.
Well, let's talk about that a second, because my audience is going to think me remiss if I didn't bring up the point that, you know, I can't really think of an example, certainly over any period of time, where a government hasn't turned bad. You know, I'm just, and if you're going to have one, that's why this show's Declare Your Independence, is we're really focused on the proper role of government, defense of individual rights. When it doesn't do that, then it's bad. And I'm trying to find one that's not bad.
I'm not going to argue with you. I think there's some pretty good governments emerging. I think that Turkey is doing some interesting things. I think South Africa is doing some interesting things. Brazil, most of Latin America are doing some very interesting things on making sure that there's equal access to goods and services. I mean, that's a longer discussion. And if we talk about that, we're really never going to get to Afghanistan.
Well, these people that are, Afghanistan's a perfect example. We have people there going, we want fill in the blank, and the word democracy keeps coming up. And how would you define that?
Afghanistan, people have a very different view than we do. The main demand in Afghanistan that I've heard is not for, quote, democracy. It's for ending the wars that have been fought in and over their countries for so long. In Afghanistan, this is not a country that has a history of a strong national government. This is a country that has a history of small local government, unlike Iraq, for instance, that has a long history of strong national identity. Identity in Afghanistan is largely at a much smaller, more local level. Identity is with family, clan, tribe, linguistic group, maybe province at the most. But what happens in Kabul is not really very relevant to most people's lives.
No, that's a very good point.
Yeah, 80% of the people of Afghanistan don't live in cities. The cities aren't that big to begin with, but 80% live in tiny little hamlets scattered over the country.
And they try to get
that imposing the kind of government that we've tried to impose there was never going to work.
Well, they always try to get some kind of a national identity. We need a national soccer team. We need an Olympic athlete. We want to turn Afghanistan into a homogenous society, which is, I don't know, it hadn't worked over the past millennia. But that is the first thing that they need to do to try and get a national identity so they can put you on one collective and then rule. And so I can see that that's been more successful in other areas. I want to talk about Bahrain a little bit, is that what happened in Bahrain, I don't see how they can ignore that. And for the same kind of reasonings that you would think would give us the influence or the inclination to go and help the people in the streets peacefully protesting in Bahrain, they do a no-fly zone and go invade Libya. I mean, is this hypocrisy lost on the people there?
No, I don't think so. And I think people in the rest of the region outside of Libya are looking very carefully at this level of double standards that's applied. It's certainly evident in the question of Yemen or Bahrain, both of which have governments that the U.S. government is very dependent on. In Bahrain, for hosting the Fifth Fleet of the U.S. Navy, and in Yemen, which has played, the Yemeni government has allowed the U.S. to use drone strikes against Yemenis in the so-called global war on terror. So both of those governments have had very strong relations with the U.S. government for many years, and their payback is they expect to be allowed to do what they want internally, no matter how repressive they get. One of the challenges facing the Obama administration right now is whether the reality of a region-wide uprising for democracy and against repression in the Middle East is going to lead to a change of a real kind of change, where we no longer say that our foreign policy in the Middle East is one that's grounded in the longstanding triad of Israel, oil, and stability, and instead is something entirely different, one that's based on internationalism, international law. Now, I think you probably disagree with this, but this is my view, and the question of treating other countries on the basis of equality and dignity, and not based on just what's good for people who happen to have been born in this country.
You know, the one thing the main thing is I just look for consistency. I mean, if they're, you know, they look at, I give you a good example. Yesterday, they had reported that Obama was saying, no, we don't anticipate asking for any increase in funding for the military for our actions in Libya. Well, I about, you know, spit all over my computer screen. You know, I was like,
well, that's because there's a huge amount of money in the Pentagon budget that allows them to do this kind of thing. The problem is if it goes on for very long, because we know in the very first day they carried out about 110 Tomahawk bombing raids. Those bombs cost about $1 million apiece. That's $110 million for that first day, just for the Tomahawk missiles. That doesn't even count the $10,000 an hour, more or less, that these warships cost. And there's several of them there, and the planes, and what the military people that are doing it. So this is something that we really can't afford. You know, if we look at what's happening right now, for example, in Wisconsin, where people are fighting back, it's because there's no money. Their deficit is caused by the fact that they're spending too much on wars that we don't support, don't need.
When we come back with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, I want to talk about, what does our Constitution say about this? Should we even be allowed to do these foreign adventures? Something to talk about. We'll be right back with Phyllis Bennis in just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free.
And everybody else listening knows we just want to break free. Now, we have our special guest, Phyllis Bennis. She has done a lot of writing on Middle East, on Palestinian-Israeli issues, Afghanistan, what's going on in the Middle East, and certainly Libya. And the one question I have for you, Phyllis, is there a justifiable military involvement, U.S. use American taxpayer money go do something somewhere else? Or are you more, we just need to take care of here? Or what's your philosophy on that?
No, I'm an internationalist. And I don't think we have any right to say that all that matters is what happens here. We live in a world, and if the world is not safe and secure, we're not going to be either. So that's my starting point. I believe in international law. I believe in the United Nations. That probably is a little bit different than some of your listeners. I don't know. But for me, the question of being consistent and not operating on the basis of double standards and hypocrisy is very important. So if we're going to talk about an international responsibility to respond to the crisis in Libya, good. I support that. It doesn't mean necessarily military force, but an international engagement does make sense. But only if we're also going to say that about Bahrain, about Yemen, and about Israel, and not accept the notion that because the U.S. is willing to protect Israel, that we have that we're not allowed to talk about it somehow.
Is there a limit, I mean, capacity to do it? I mean, how much of a lower standard of living should the Americans suffer in order to do this kind of international policing?
Well, I don't think that most Americans would have to. I think that the upper 1% of this country, the corporate CEOs and the corporate bankers and the ones who are the heads of the money market accounts, those are the people who got us into the financial crisis. Those are the people who are making, in many cases, 250 times what the workers in their own factory earns, for instance. Yeah, I think those people can afford to give up their privileged standard of living. They don't need 15 Mercedes and 3 planes and 5 houses. I'm perfectly prepared to say they should give up their standard of living. The rest of us, yeah, we may have to deal with some consumption issues. We are 5% of the world's population, and we consume more than 30% of its resources. I'm not okay with that. I'm not okay with that.
So who decides? I mean, yeah, you're right. We can get into a philosophical decision. I'm sure my audience understands my position.
It's about what happens in the real world. Our planet can't support that for very much longer. That's what climate change is about. That's what these wars over oil, which are soon going to be wars over water, that's what they're about, is over scarce resources, and they're getting scarcer all the time.
So
we're using them up too fast.
So the international community should be run or ruled by what philosophy?
I don't think philosophies rule. I think people rule. I think that there are things about international law that we should be following, and there should be some kind of equality that because a country is rich and powerful, that somehow it's not obligated to abide by the same rules that everybody else is.
You know,
I think most people in this country want that, too.
I had a gentleman on, what was it, Reuben or Pearl? He had written a book. I keep getting them mixed up. And it was in 2004, so he wrote a book. And the point that he was making is that the entire planet, over half the people, exist on less than $3 a day. And that was a justification by which we make too much and we need to be living on less so that they can live better. And my question is, at what expense to us? I owe someone else what? I mean, are you asking for a global tax of some kind?
There's an interesting plan, actually, for a very tiny global tax, not on you and me, unless you're a lot richer than I think you are. But a tiny global tax, it would be something like 0.1%, or maybe even less than that, maybe 0.1%, on financial transactions. So it's a tax on speculators. It's a tax on the rich speculators who have done so much damage to all of our economies. If there was that kind of a tiny tax, a group here at my institute has been working on it, it would produce billions of dollars every year because the amounts of money that are in these international financial transactions are so much bigger than any of us ever imagine that it would pay for AIDS drugs in all of Africa, for instance, clean water for every child in South Asia who today doesn't have clean water. I mean, it would pay for the enormous human needs that are so much less costly than these wars that we continue to fund as if there was no tomorrow.
You know, I understand that sentiment, and we've had a lot of guests, and we've had a pleasant conversation on that. And my my first impulse is that no matter how much money we raise, one, they're going to want more. Two, you've created an infrastructure by which they're taking it from you. Three, you got who's in charge of redistributing it and who it goes, because it always winds up being the poor people in a rich country are funding the rich people in a poor country. I mean, that's the problem that we have right now.
That's been a big problem, and we should deal with that. I agree with you. I think that's a serious problem. We need a better way. More foreign aid isn't necessarily the issue. It's, for example, debt relief in poor countries goes much further. So there's a lot of solutions out there. There's no absence of solutions. What there is an absence of political will.
Well, you know, debt relief means somebody doesn't get paid back, and especially if it was my money, I'm kind of, you know, concerned about that. But, you know,
are you concerned about your money that's going to pay for wars that you don't approve
of? Absolutely.
That's what's happening. If we look, for example, I started to give this one example in Wisconsin, and I know we only have a couple of more minutes, but I just wanted to say, the people in Wisconsin who are fighting for the right to organize and the right to have their unions recognized and not to have these massive cutbacks, the state deficit that they're facing is $1.8 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. That's not chump change.
No, here in Arizona, we got as big a problem.
Well, how much money do you think the people of Wisconsin are paying in taxes just for their share of this year's war in Afghanistan? Turns out it's almost exactly the same amount. It's $1.7 billion of Wisconsin tax money is going directly to the war in Afghanistan.
You know, this brings up a good point.
They wouldn't have a state deficit.
A very hardcore, no-compromise, anarchist, libertarian economist made the point that when they were doing Obamacare was starting to come out, and the national health care system, he's going, before we went into Iraq and this was still an issue, then he's going, look, if you want national, I'll even give that to you if you'll stop waging war. You know, even though he's hardcore anarchist, you know, if you'll do that, you want to play New Zealand and have national health care. You can assure us that you're not going to wage war anymore, you know, maybe that sword I won't fall on. But it seems that whenever you create a mechanism by which they can pull money or extract it and have it to spend, regardless of whether it's United Nations or NATO or something, they always find an excuse to go to war.
Well, let me just give you one example of why things work sometimes better than you think. We have two really successful national health care systems in this country. And the people on them, the only demand they have is don't take them away. You have Social Security, you have Medicare that is providing health care for everybody over 65, pretty decent health care. Lots of doctors will only take Medicare these days. And you have the military medical system, which works really well for veterans.
Are these systems that you would like to see in the Middle East? You know, they adopt our system or our influence over there, that they can expect national health care in, say, Egypt?
Well, the irony is almost all of them have it. Libya, as a matter of fact, was number one in the ratings this year in the Human Development Index. That tracks 10 categories, things like maternal mortality, how many women don't die in childbirth, how many kids have primary education, how is the health care of the system. They have national health care. People in Tunisia, I know Tunisian Americans here, two of them, they go home to go to the dentist because it's free there.
Phyllis, are you able to say another segment or you got to go?
I really can't. I've got to go on to another one.
Phyllis, thanks for spending time with us and giving your perspective. You know, we really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, too.
Phyllis Bennis, Institute for Policy Studies.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Take it.
No, sir, no.
You must take it.
You cannot offer me this ring.
I'm giving it to you.
Don't tempt me, Frodo. I dare not take it. Not even to keep it safe. Understand, Frodo. I would use this ring from a desire to do good. But through me, it would wield a power too great and terrible to imagine.
But it cannot stay in the Shire.
No. No, it can't.
What must I do?
What must I do? We have just heard from Phyllis Bennis. It was nice of her to come on and, you know, bear the burden of having to talk to a libertarian. And, of course, it didn't take very long for her to understand our perspective. But she helps us understand the perspective of many others, do a lot of research over there. Whenever this is the trend that I see. They look for an opportunity to find where there's injustices. And they, of course, want to use force to bring about justice, social justice. I am of the opinion that by getting access to the minds of young people that are all over this world are connected via the internet, that for the first time would hear the concepts of liberty, of self-ownership, how do you forget that? How do you unlearn that truth? Well, she was afraid of it. And she made it clear that she didn't want to share that one with anybody. So we can't count on her being a grapevine root getting this information out. But do you think we had any kind of impact on her thinking? No, of course not. We didn't get to talk about it. She is director of the New Internationalism Project. Well, that title, that'll tell you what's up right there. Internationalist. She's advocating for a global tax. Now, just on the rich, just on they, them, those that, you know, deserve to be taxed, you know, and you know our opinion on that. But what happens is they always, you know, we got the ring of power, the lever of power. Once you, of course, you'll want to do good with it, but through her or the institutions that she advocates, it would wield such evil. Because it didn't even cross her mind that we shouldn't be involved. She's an internationalist. You know, you got to look at it from a libertarian perspective to see how the neocons and the right are just the same coin, just the other side of what Phyllis Bennis was advocating. Of course, they want us to go around the world and doing whatever for whatever reasons that they have. She wants to do it for whatever reasons she has. And I remember, you know, I really should look up the book. I remember it was Pearl or Rubin. You know, it was one of the, they both were in the Clinton administration. It had something to do with that. And I remember how it came about. I was doing a morning show, and I was afternoon at the time, and the morning show had some problem. People were sick or they had to go whatever, and they asked me to fill in, cover the morning show. Well, they had this gentleman booked. And they go, well, you want us to cancel? And just I go, no, bring him on. Just give me his book. All I got to do is look at, you know, the foreword and kind of read the first couple of pages and then read the last few pages of the book. And I'm sure I'll get it. Sure enough, there it was. There are so many poor people on this planet. The rich people need to take them under their wing. And we live a lower standard of living to provide them with a minimal standard of living by the standard that somebody created. Healthcare. AIDS, water, food. At what point you have half of the population of the entire planet living on a few dollars a day? And that was then. I bet it's even less now with inflation, certainly the purchasing power. So what can we do to really help these people? Free them. Free them between the ears. Free them from the concept that they must be ruled and taxed. Free them, free us. Do we seek what they advocate? You know, peace, prosperity? Of course we do. Do we seek it for all human beings across the planet? Or we just want it for us and they're not allowed? Of course we want people to be free, to prosper, to have a high standard of living. Of course! Because if we don't advocate it for every soul, then we're not going to get it. I find these people, are they misinformed or are they what? What agenda do they have? Do they seek control? Do they seek a certain advocacy of some program that they want? I mean, she's going on about how Medicare and Medicaid, you know, is a good thing. And I'm going, wow, seriously? I mean, if you just got government out of the way, I'd be trading chicken eggs for heart transplants. I mean, you know, I, and you think I'm kidding. You know, this is if you free people to interact voluntarily without licensing and all these regulations and controls and mandated insurance and what is and isn't covered and all this, it drives me crazy. I could spend an entire show on just talking about collective bargaining and what's happening with state budgets and so on. And she's just, if we just stop the wars, then look at all that money that we could redistribute for what they wanted. Don't even address the debt. Or the constitutionality of us invading or going. It wasn't that we did it. It was how we did it. And what other countries we should do it in. And how this, it always turns bad. They don't want to talk about that. We got a lot of work to do. And that's why I was so excited about Atlas Shrugged coming out. Because I know anyone that has done any research on not the book, but the impact of the book. I remember watching some black and white Mike Wallace talk show interviews with Ayn Rand right after she released Atlas Shrugged. And of course, it's in black and white and it's kind of a dark studio and there's cigarette smoke going everywhere. I mean, everybody smoked on television back in the day. And in this smoke-filled haze, you have Mike Wallace, which you may know now has been on 60 Minutes, I guess he's on, or was. And but he was a young man at one time, and he's interviewing Ayn Rand. The criticism and the full press media blitz on how evil her concept of objectivism or the proper role of government, they didn't want the infection into the minds of America of I own myself. Now, Ayn had problems when it comes to foreign policy because she came from Russia. She saw it as kind of the evil empire, kind of the Reagan thing, and that we were obligated as taxpayers and human beings in America to go free people around the world. So we hear a lot from the objectivists and from Randians and a lot of Ayn Rand's proteges and so on talking about what our foreign policy should be to go free people with our tax money. So I would find that interesting, if not a contradiction, certainly. But that's where libertarianism is not objectivism. Libertarianism is about coercion. It's about force. If you have to use force to extract the money from individuals, to pay for the force that's imposed on other people around the world, you know, how can you be good? How can you not expect to have abuses? Okay. So I'm interested in if foreign policy makes it into the Atlas Shrugged movie and how that's portrayed. We're in a very interesting time. You know, I always thought I was born at just the right time to kind of get a perspective on a lot of things. I was born in 61, so I was just old enough to remember when Neil Armstrong first stepped on the moon. You know, that was very inspirational for a lot of us. At the time, the most advanced thing in your automobile was, you know, the spark plug and an AM radio. I mean, you know, how then we got Pong and all the variations of video games that we saw as technology took over. And then the internet and all of this is, it's all empowering individuals to be able to communicate directly to uncover the secrets and expose the lies. Let me tell you what the big lie is. In order to get us to capitulate, to allow the theft, murder in our name, there's a promise that governments always make to defend our individual rights. But the first thing they advocate, once you give them that power to be there, is to take your money. I can't get past that. We have a lot of work to do, and I'm going to need your help because I want to be free just like you do. Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what readersoffreedomsphoenix.com get every day. Readersoffreedomsphoenix.com are constantly provided the information that detail the real news between the lines of propaganda about government policies and the true relationship we all have with coercive governments. Learn the true condition of our economy, innovations and technological breakthroughs in energy, health, computer science, and space travel. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media, the media that is so last century. Corporate media has evolved into nothing more than distributors of government propaganda, but we now have a fantastic alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com provides constant news updates on the issues that affect our lives in the most important ways. Our liberty and our property are under constant attack, and FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda while encouraging the participation of our readers. Join us at FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com, where the revolution between the ears has already matured.